drill display of different coloured cards flipped and held up to form a sequence of giant images, all timed to music, gymnastics, or marching. Though none of us said it, we all used to worry about the single slip that could ruin the entire display. That filled me with terror. We practiced endlessly, and to perfection. Each of us had a large pack containing all our cards, which we displayed in order. We were led by a conductor who stood at the front, holding up the number of the next card. When she gave the signal, everyone held up that card in unison. The final pattern in the display formed a vast image of the great leader's face with a shimmering gold wreath around it, which the children moved to give it a dazzle effect. We never got to see the visual display that we were creating, but when the stadium was full and we heard the roar of the crowd, with tens of thousands chanting "Long life" over and over, "Man City, Man City, Man City," the adrenaline was electrifying. At the end of that first year of secondary school, the ceremonies held on the anniversary of the Korean War affected me deeply and made me very emotional. The day began at school with outdoor speeches from our teachers and headmaster. They opened with the solemn words, spoken into a microphone, "On the morning of the 25th of June 1950, at 3 a.m, the South Korean enemy attacked our country while our people slept and killed many innocents." The images conjured for us of tanks rolling across the border and slaughtering our people in their homes moved us all to floods of tears. The South Koreans had made victims of us. I burned with thoughts of vengeance and righting injustice. All the children felt the same. We talked afterwards of what we would do to a South Korean if we ever saw one. Despite the endless and exhausting communal activities, I had one private realm I could escape to. In books. Reading was a habit I picked up from my mother. I had picture books of fairy tales, myths, and folk tales. I had a Korean edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, a story I loved, but it had some pages glued together by the censor, and it was impossible to peel them apart. Tales of heroes struggling against oppression were permitted as long as they fitted the North Korean revolutionary worldview, but any inconvenient details got blotted out. By the second year of secondary school, I was reading North Korean spy thrillers. Some of them were so gripping they kept me up late, by candlelight. The best one was about a North Korean special agent operating in South Korea. He lived there with his South Korean wife, never telling her his true identity. He was controlled directly by the head of secret espionage operations, a figure he'd never met face to face, but with whom he'd formed a relationship over time. The story climaxes when he discovers that his controller is his own wife. The best stories had endings that were obvious all along, and yet took the reader completely by surprise. One evening at the start of my second year at secondary school, I came home to find my mother cooking a special dinner to mark my father's first day in a new job. I had known for a while that he was leaving the Air Force, but I wasn't talking to him much these days, and taking little interest in what he told me. When he arrived home, I saw him wearing a civilian suit for the first time. He looked smart and quite different. I was so used to seeing his grey-blue uniform. He was now working for a trading company, which was controlled by the military. He was grinning broadly and said he would be crossing into China next week on business. He showed me his new passport. I had never seen a passport before, but affected a lack of interest. My mother, however, was in high spirits. A husband with permission to travel abroad was a real mark of status. We were moving up in the world. The only time I spoke to him over dinner, and not very respectfully, was to ask what he actually did in this fancy new job. He gave me some vague, unspecific response. Clearly it was supposed to be some big secret. I rolled my eyes and left the table, which angered my mother. My father remained silent. I knew I had hurt him, but I felt more resentful towards him than ever. This was yet another fact being kept hidden from me. The pain I felt over the truth about my parentage had not lessened at all. I did not realize that in not telling me about his job, he was trying to protect me. My father began crossing into China on business, sometimes staying away for a night or two. It was very fortunate, therefore, that he happened to be at home with my mother on the evening of the fire. About 2 months later, I had gone to bed very early, aching and exhausted after mass games practice, and was already asleep next to Minol, when my mother's cry awoke me, and my father came crashing into the room. Behind him was a flickering orange light, and everywhere a sharp reek of aviation fuel. We saved nothing from the house but the clothes we had on and the portraits my father had snatched from the wall just seconds before the roof collapsed. All my picture books, my novels, and my beloved accordion and guitar were destroyed. But there was something else I treasured that was also destroyed by the fire. Something so dangerous to possess that it could have got us sent to a prison camp. Looking back, the fire may have been a mighty stroke of luck. Chapter 10. Rocky Island. A few months before the fire, one of my best friends had gathered a close-knit group of us together in the schoolyard. I tended to make friends with older girls from similar backgrounds. This friend was the daughter of the city's chief of police. She'd heard that cassette tapes of illegal South Korean pop music could be bought, very discreetly, from certain dealers. Soon we were in possession of some of this red-hot criminal contraband. We were among the first in North Korea to hear these new hits. A small group of us began secretly meeting up on the weekends in the houses of one of us, and when parents and siblings were out, we'd dance and sing along to the music of the South Korean singers Ju Hyunmi and Hyun Chul, twirling around and jiving our hips, keeping the volume low. We made up our own moves. In truth, we had very little idea of how people danced to pop. We knew we were not supposed to enjoy the archenemy's music. But we did not realize quite how grave our crime was until the news spread around Haesan that some local women had been sentenced to a prison camp for partying to South Korean pop. One in their group had denounced the others. After that, I listened to the tapes alone at home, lying on my bed. My favourite was a song called Rocky Island by the singer Kim Won-jun. The Rocky Island of the title referred to a woman he loved, and the chorus went, "Even if you don't like me, I love you so much. Even if I can't wake up, I love you so much." I adored this mush. It was about teenage love, and touched my heart in a way that filled me with longing. It was changing me, making me feel I was growing up. I got nothing like this from North Korean music. Our country had pop music of its own, but with songs called Our Happiness in Our General's Embrace, or Young People Forward, I cringed to listen to it. I taught myself to play Rocky Island on my accordion. I took care to play quietly, keeping the door and windows shut. But one morning while I was practicing, a hard knock sounded on the front door. I froze. One of our neighbours was on the doorstep. He was on his way to work. He told me he had heard me playing. A pool of cold fear gathered in the pit of my stomach. Was he going to denounce me, or just warn me? But to my great surprise, he smiled and told me that hearing that song made him emotional and gave him energy. Then he got back on his bicycle and rode off. It was such a weird thing to say. I wonder now if he knew full well it was a South Korean song and was reaching out to me, giving me a signal, like a secret handshake. A few months later, by the time the illicit pop cassettes had gone up in flames with the house, I knew all the songs off by heart. The melody and lyrics of Rocky Island especially would be a great comfort to me in the times ahead. The South Korean pop songs had given me a vague awareness of a universe beyond the borders of North Korea. If I'd had more awareness, in general, I might have spotted clues indicating that the world outside was undergoing dramatic changes. Changes so great that the regime was being put under stresses it had never experienced before. I was oblivious to the fact that the Russians had allowed communism to collapse in the Soviet Union, without even a shot fired, as Kim Jong-il would put it. But this was affecting our country in ways that were starting to become impossible for the regime to conceal. My parents' jobs and business dealings meant that we had enough food. I had not yet noticed that the rations of basic food essentials provided by the public distribution system were dwindling or becoming irregular. Nor had I paid attention when the government launched a widely publicized campaign in 1992 called Let Us Eat Two Meals a Day, which it said was healthier than eating three. Anyone who hadn't yet figured out a money-making hustle of their own was still depending on the state for essentials, and they were beginning to suffer. As it happened, our next move as a family took us to the very edge of that world outside, as close to it as anyone could go, as if fortune was contriving to make us look outward. Our new house faced directly onto the bank of the Yalu River itself. I could throw a stone from our front gate, over the water, into China. Chapter 11. The House is Cursed. Our new neighbourhood was a cluster of single-storey homes separated by narrow alleyways. The house was larger than previous houses we'd lived in, painted white, with a tiled roof, and surrounded by a white concrete wall. It had three rooms, each the width of the building, so that we had to go through the kitchen area to the main room, and through that to the back room, which is where the four of us slept. My mother had paid a lot of money for it. Officially, there is no private property in North Korea, and no real estate business. But in reality, people who have been allocated desirable or conveniently located housing often do sell or swap them if the price is right. The location of this house was perfect for my mother's illicit enterprises. She could arrange for goods to be smuggled from just a few yards away in China, straight over the river to our front door. For security against the rampant thievery, she had the wall around the house built higher, to about 6 feet, and bought a fierce, trained dog from the military. The entrance was through a gate in the front wall that we kept heavily locked. We had to pass through a total of 3 doors and 5 locks just to come and go. In front of the house was a path that ran along the riverside, 5 yards from our front gate, along which the guards patrolled in pairs. Uncle Opium and Aunt Pretty dropped by and congratulated my mother. The location couldn't be better, they said. Minho was extremely excited about this new home. It was a warm, mild autumn, and the day we moved in, he saw boys his own age playing in the river, mixing with Chinese boys from the other side, while their mothers washed clothes along the banks. To most North Koreans, the borders are impassable barriers. Our country is sealed shut from neighbouring countries. And yet here were 5, 6, and 7-year-old boys splashing and flitting between the two banks, North Korea's and China's, like the fish and the birds. The next day, my mother went to introduce herself to the neighbours. What they told her made her heart sink to her stomach. She returned to the house looking angry and pale. "The house is cursed," she said, slumping to the floor and covering her face with her hands. "I've made a terrible mistake." A neighbour had told her that a child of the previous occupants had died in an accident. My mother thought she'd been lucky to find the place. But in fact, the occupants were selling in a hurry to escape the association with tragedy and bad luck. I tried to comfort her, but she shook her head and looked tired. Her superstitions ran too deep to be reasoned with. I half believed it myself. Many of my mother's beliefs were rubbing off on me. I could tell she was already thinking of another expensive session with a fortune teller to see if she could get the curse lifted. My mother quickly furnished the house, once again doing her makeover. People who could afford them had started buying refrigerators coming from China, but my mother was reluctant to attract attention. This meant daily shopping for food, almost all of which she obtained at the local semi-official markets, not from the public distribution system. Her director at the government bureau where she worked had recently been sent to a prison camp after inspectors had found food in his home that he had been given as a bribe, so my mother was especially careful. We never stocked up on rice, seldom keeping more than 20 or 30 kilos in the house. The one luxury we did buy for the new house was a Toshiba colour television, which was a signal of social status. The television would expand my horizon, and Minho's, dramatically. Not for the news it broadcast. We had one channel, Korea Central Television, which showed endlessly repeated footage of the great leader or the dear leader visiting factories, schools or farms and delivering their on-the-spot guidance on everything from nitrate fertilisers to women's shoes. Nor for the entertainment, which consisted of old North Korean movies, pioneers performing in musical ensembles, or vast army choruses praising the revolution and the party. Its attraction was that we could pick up Chinese TV stations that broadcast soap operas and glamorous commercials for luscious products. Though we could not understand Mandarin, just watching them provided a window onto an entirely different way of life. Watching foreign TV stations was highly illegal and a very serious offence. Our mother scolded us severely when she caught us. But I was naughty. I'd put blankets over the windows and watch when she was out or sleeping. We were now living in a sensitive area politically. The government knew that people living along the river often succumbed to the poison of capitalism and traded smuggled goods, watched pernicious foreign television programs, and even defected. Families living in this area were monitored much more closely than others by the Puibu for any sign of disloyalty. A family that fell under suspicion might be watched and reported on daily by the local police. Often, subterfuge was used to catch offenders. One morning, not long after we'd moved in, a pleasant and friendly man knocked on the door and told my mother that he had heard that the Yankees paid a lot of money for the returned remains of their soldiers killed during the Korean War. He had some bones himself, he said, disinterred from various sites in the province. He wondered if my mother could help him smuggle them across the border. My mother treated requests for help with extreme caution. She knew how undercover Puibu agents operated, dropping by with intriguing propositions. They had all kinds of tricks. We'd heard from one high-ranking family who had got into serious trouble when investigators turned up at their children's kindergarten and asked brightly, "What's the best movie you've seen lately?" And a child had enthusiastically described a South Korean blockbuster, watched on a legal video. On this occasion, however, her superstitions were her best defence. She didn't want to be haunted by the disturbed spirits of American soldiers, and told the man she couldn't help. In mid-November, a few weeks after we had moved to the new house, the first snow had been falling all day in fine grains that stung our faces. We were huddled on the floor for warmth, wearing our coats indoors when my father arrived home. Each time he returned from China, he brought with him small luxuries that were out of reach for most people. Sometimes he came with good quality toilet paper, or bananas and oranges, which were almost never available at home. This time he was carrying such an enormous package that I failed to affect my usual boredom in his presence. I was too curious to know what it was. It contained gifts for Mino and me. Mine was a larger-than-life doll with silky white blonde hair, blue eyes, and a pale Western face. She had the most beautiful dress, of patterned gingham trimmed with lace. She was so large I could barely carry her. I had to prop her up in a corner next to my bed. My mother said she could hear me chattering to her. Mino's gift was a handheld Game Boy video game. His little face was overawed. This was something so new. We knew of no one else who had anything like it. I can only think of that doll now with immense sadness. I was a little too old for a doll, but it was such a beautiful, generous gift. I realize now that my father felt he had lost me and was trying to reconnect with me somehow. He knew something had gone badly wrong between us, and he had probably figured out what it was. I certainly did not deserve the gift. It was the last thing he ever gave me. Chapter 12. Tragedy at the Bridge. I was about to turn 14, by the Korean way of measuring age. It was January 1994, the beginning of an eventful and tragic year that made me grow up quickly. I was now almost as tall as my mother. I was fit and active, playing a lot of sport, which I enjoyed very much, ice skating, becoming good enough to represent the school in a tournament, and taekwondo indoors when the weather was cold. I was a good runner, and had run the Haesan Half Marathon. My birthday, however, got the year off to a terrible start. I had long been pushing my luck with my appearance. The teachers had never taken much notice when I didn't wear the school uniform. They knew they could depend on my mother when the school needed cash donations or fuel for heating. But I was not a child anymore, and my nonconformity was becoming conspicuous. The inevitable happened. A new teacher had joined the school a few months previously. Her name was Mrs. Kang, and she taught physics. She was a young woman with small, sharp eyes and a shrill voice. On the day of my birthday, she wished us good morning and noticed me immediately. Every girl was in school uniform and all had short hair, no longer than shoulder length. I stood out a mile in my pink Chinese coat and my perm and a new pair of tall, fashionable boots. Her eyes froze on the boots, and I knew I'd gone too far. "Why are you wearing those?" She was addressing me in front of the whole class. "And for that matter, why aren't you ever in uniform like everyone else?" Before I could stop myself, the words were out. "Why do you have a problem? My mother doesn't." The room tensed.
"How dare you talk back to me?"
She was shrieking and marching up to my desk.
"You want to look like some rotten capitalist? Fine!"
She swung her arm out and slapped me hard across the face. I put my hand to my cheek. The blood was singing in my ears. I was shaking and outraged. My mother had never slapped me. I stormed out of the class and ran home in tears. That day, for the first time in a long time, I yearned for the comfort and security my father always provided. But he was away again, on a business trip to China. Each time he came home, he seemed more and more tired and subdued. My mother said he wasn't sleeping. Something was wrong. He told her he thought he was being watched. I realize now that having the nerve to wear those boots and perm my hair was just a symptom of a deeper and general disillusion I was feeling. I was falling out of love with the organizational life and the collective activities that no one in the country was exempt from. Now that I was 14, I was no longer a pioneer and had to join the Socialist Youth League. This was another important milestone. We were told to start thinking of our futures and of how we would serve our country. My childhood was over. Members of the Socialist Youth League had to undergo military training. I had to put on army fatigues and learn how to shoot with live ammunition at a firing range in Haisan. I hated this so much, and my mother was so nervous about me being surrounded by children with guns, where accidents could easily happen, and sometimes did, that she got me excused by bribing the school authorities with cash. Ideological indoctrination intensified. As model communist youths, we were now expected to deepen our emotional bond with the great leader and start learning about the party's ideology of Juche, loosely translated as self-reliance, which promoted our country's isolation and rejection of all foreign influences. I was now part of a Socialist Youth League cell within my secondary school. Fortunately, I managed to avoid joining the Maintenance of Social Order Brigade, the vigilantes who monitored the streets for citizens whose ideological purity had lapsed. By 1994, there were several additions to the list of banned items. Now the youths were cracking down on anyone caught wearing clothing with Western lettering, which was in vogue in China. By the time spring came, there was no avoiding the revolutionary duty we all had to undertake. The pilgrimage to the sacred site surrounding Mount Paektu. The mountains of Yangang province were where Kim Il-sung fought as a guerrilla against the Japanese in the 1930s and 1940s. To mark this significance, three of the province's 11 counties were renamed after the great man's wife, father, and uncle. Young pioneers and socialist youth from all over North Korea visited this outdoor revolutionary museum with its statues and monuments to the great leader's victories and a nearby village called Pochombo, where in 1937 he had led a band of 150 guerrillas in an attack on the local Japanese police station. The battle is famous in North Korean history as the great turning point in the struggle for Korean independence and stunning proof of Kim Il-sung's tactical genius, winning victory in the face of overwhelming odds. Our guide showed us bullet holes on the old police station, circled in white, and a cell where the Japanese had tortured communist partisans. None of this impressed me. I just wanted to get out of there. With a tremendous effort, I had to control my face to hide my boredom. Only when I finally saw, with my own eyes, the preserved log cabin beneath the pines on the slopes of Mount Pektu, the site of the secret guerrilla base where Kim Jong-il was born, did I feel like a child again, just for a moment. I remembered painting the cabin, and the star in the sky, and the rainbow over Mount Pektu. This magical story still had the power to move me. The disaffection I was feeling meant that my relationship with Minho wasn't getting any better. He was at elementary school in Haesam. He'd hear from the boys in his year what a cute girl their older brothers thought I was. He must have thought they were talking about someone else. I still wasn't friends with him in the way I should have been. Deep down, I wanted an older brother to protect me, not a kid I had to watch out for. He was now 7 years old and developing quite an adventurous streak. I strongly suspected him of making secret forays of his own to the opposite bank of the river. He could be dogged, too. Given a chore, he'd get on with it. His school once gave the students an absurd quota of 10 kilos each of berries to pick. He was the only one to hit the target. In that sense, he was quite unlike me, who would find excuses to avoid physical work and not get my nice clothes dirty. The one thing we both had in common was the Haesan stubbornness, like our mothers. A few days after the visit to Mount Pektu, I came home from school to find my mother pacing around the house in a state of high anxiety. "Your father's still not back," she said, folding and unfolding her arms. My father was supposed to have returned from his business trip to China the previous day. She said he had seemed particularly anxious before leaving. 2 days went by, and still he did not return. By the third day, my mother was a wreck. She could not relax, sleep, eat, or sit still. She tried several times to contact the bureau of the trading company where he worked, but each time was stonewalled and told to wait for information. Another day passed in a dismal limbo. Minho was constantly asking if someone could check where our father was. Finally, a work colleague from the trading company called at the house. The news was not good. My father had been arrested 4 days ago at the Friendship Bridge as he crossed the border back into North Korea. Chapter 13. Sunlight on Dark Water. A group of men from Pyongyang were waiting for my father at the bridge. They were officers of the Military Security Command. This organization is separate from the Military of State Security, the Puibu. It is a secret police that watches the military. Another 10 days went by with no news. We knew only that he had been detained while investigations were made into his business conduct. To the outside world, my mother presented the hardened, no-nonsense mask she always wore. At home, she became brittle and tearful. She began to steel herself for the worst. She knew that few people ever emerged from such detentions unharmed, or even emerged at all. I had never seen her like this. It was while she was in this restless state that she told me a family story I had never heard before. It concerned the marriage of Aunt Old, my mother's eldest sister. She had been married before I was born and had 3 children I did not know about. Her husband had been a Korean-Chinese man who had escaped the Cultural Revolution in China in the late 1960s to what he thought was a communist utopia in North Korea. My mother said he was a kind man with a very forthright and honest nature. My grandmother opposed the marriage because he was a foreigner, but Aunt Old said she would rather die if she couldn't be with him. And so they were married. After a few years, he got sick of the propaganda and said he wanted to return to China. Aunt Old refused to leave home, so he went alone and was stopped at the border. Had he told the border police he simply wanted to visit family in China and return to North Korea, he might have got off lightly. But his honesty was his undoing. He told his interrogators that he had become disenchanted. They sent him straight to a political prison camp without trial. My grandmother then stepped in to protect the family and fixed it so that Aunt Old could divorce her husband and put the 3 children up for adoption. This way, the family could avoid the guilt by association with a criminal element that would degrade their Songbun and blight the family for generations. This is a common arrangement when a spouse is imprisoned. The 3 children were each adopted by good families. One of them became an army officer. Aunt Old met him when he had grown up and told him the story. He broke down and hugged her, swearing that he didn't care about his family background, and from then on wanted his real mother and siblings to be his family. This son travelled to the prison camp to try and meet his father, but was turned away at the gates. There are two kinds of prison in the Gulag. One is for prisoners sentenced to revolutionary re-education through labour. If they survive their punishment, they will be released back into society and monitored closely for the rest of their lives. The other is a zone of no return. Prisoners there are worked to death. The son feared that his father was in the second type and was still there. This story distressed me a lot. On the rare occasions we mentioned anyone we knew who had fallen foul of the authorities, we did so without analysis or judgment, or any comment on the fairness of the punishment. We just described the bare facts. That's how North Koreans talk. But now my mother was speaking emotionally of how the Gulag had affected our own family. No one spoke openly of the Gulag. We knew of it only through terrifying rumours and whispers. We did not know where the camps were located or what conditions there were like. All I knew about was Paekum County, a less extreme place of punishment not far from Haesan. We knew a family who'd been deported there from Pyongyang because the father had rolled a cigarette using a square of cut newspaper without noticing that the great leader's face was printed on the other side. His whole family was sent to the mountains for a back-breaking life of potato digging on the 10.18 collective farm. Now I was picturing my father being sent to a prison camp. A great fog swirled in my head. The resentment I'd felt towards him was becoming a mess of confused feelings. While we were waiting for news, five uniformed military officials hammered on our door one evening, entered without removing their boots, and ransacked our home in search of cash and valuables my father had allegedly hidden. They ripped open the walls, tore up the floor, and pulled down the ceiling. They left, empty-handed, after an hour of destruction. My mother and I were in shock as we stared about at the damage. Our house was completely wrecked. About 2 weeks after my father had disappeared, my mother was told that he had suddenly been released to the hospital in Haesan. When she saw him, she was overwhelmed and began sobbing freely. His appearance shocked her. He was haggard, with sunken eyes, but he tried to give her a grin. He seemed much older. The investigation into him was still ongoing, he said. He'd been accused of bribery and abuse of position. A more likely reason was that he had fallen out of political favour, or had put some senior cadre's nose out of joint. He had been interrogated many times and ordered to write his confession over and over again. Each time, the interrogator ripped it up in his face and told him to start again. My mother did not ask what else they had done to him. She did not want him to relive the trauma, but could see that he had been badly beaten and had not been allowed to sleep. At the hospital, he slept for days with the covers pulled over his head. My father kept everything bottled up, as many North Korean men did. They could not talk about their feelings, or mention the fear and stress they were under. It was the reason I would see terrible drunken fights breaking out among men in Haesan during the public holidays. My father never drank alcohol, but he turned his feelings inward. He had lost a lot of weight, and had become very listless. We realise now that he had fallen into a severe depression, an illness that is not acknowledged in North Korea. He spent about 6 weeks in the hospital in Haesan. My mother needed Mino and me out of the way while she tended to my father, visiting him daily for hours at the hospital. We were sent to the East Coast to stay with Uncle Cinema, his wife, and their children, my cousins. One afternoon, Uncle Cinema came home early. Mino and I were in the living room with our aunt and our cousins. He took his shoes off and stepped into the house, closing the door carefully behind him. Minyoung, Mino, I am afraid I have some bad news, he said. He looked grave, and we knew something terrible had happened. He told us that our mother had telephoned him at his office. She said that our father had fallen very ill in hospital and had died. Mino was devastated. He ran into the bedroom and shut the door. I walked numbly down to the beach, and gazed out into the East Sea. From behind the clouds, sharp rays made fields of light on the dark water. A few distant, rustled shipping boats were on the horizon. The sea was calm. The resentment I had nurtured towards my father had put such a wall between us. Why had I done that? I grew up understanding the importance of family and blood ties. Discovering that my blood did not come from him had shocked me and confused me. I had frozen him out. I was hurt by a secret that had been kept from me. I thought of how he'd met my mother, all those years ago on the trains of Pyongyang. He had loved her so much that he had married her even though she was divorced and had a child by another man. Memories came back to me, dozens of them, of our happy times chasing dragonflies in the fields near Anju, and of our family life in Hamhung, of the fun we'd all had together watching my mother eat Nangmyeon, of how proud I'd been of him when he came to my pioneer ceremony, how safe I'd always felt with him. I stared at the sea, and the scale of my folly came home to me. He'd raised me lovingly, as his own child. My selfish feelings had stopped me seeing how much I loved him. I fell to my knees on the beach and cried bitter tears, clawing with my hands at the sand. After what seemed like hours, as the sun was setting, I walked back to the house. I knew that I would regret for the rest of my life the way I'd behaved towards my father. Knowing that he died, thinking that I resented him, would only make my bereavement more painful over the years ahead. My father's death was a shock to everyone who knew him. He was still a young man, barely into his 40s. No one was with him when he died. But before my mother had time to react to the blow of his death, she received another devastating piece of news. The hospital death certificate stated that he had committed suicide by overdosing on diazepam, Valium. This drug was readily available in the markets. He must have gone out and bought it himself. In North Korea, suicide is taboo. Not only is it considered gravely humiliating to the surviving family members, it also guarantees that any children left behind will be reclassified as hostile in the Songbun system and denied university entrance and the chance of a good job. Suicide in Korean culture is a highly emotive means of protest. The regime regards it as a form of defection. By punishing the surviving family, the regime attempts to disable this ultimate form of protest. My mother was jolted out of her grief. She acted at once to protect us all. She had to get the hospital documentation changed very quickly, and this was a delicate and difficult task, but our futures depended on it. My mother's tact and diplomacy succeeded. It cost her nearly all her hard currency savings, but she did it. She bribed the hospital authorities. They agreed to change the cause of my father's death to heart attack. The funeral was conducted in haste before any questions were asked, and before Mino and I had arrived back from the coast. We did not even get a chance to say goodbye to him. Even worse, my father's parents had cursed my mother angrily at the funeral, telling her that she had brought ill fortune upon their family. As a final gratuitous humiliation, the investigating military authority wrote to inform my mother that my father had been formally dismissed from his post. After my father's death, I felt much closer to Mino. It was as if I was seeing him with clear vision for the first time in years. The stupid delusion that had made me withdraw from my father was the same one that had stopped me feeling close to my own sibling. I started to see him for who he was, my brother, as bereaved and as heartbroken as I was. I no longer felt the same about our house on the river. Within a short time of moving there, we'd had a tragedy in the family. It made me think the curse on that place was real and potent. We were still trying to come to terms with what had happened when an event occurred that united the entire country in grief. In such wailing, brow-beating scenes of mass hysteria as the world's media had never seen before. It was an event that reverberates in North Korea to this day. Chapter 14. The Great Heart Has Stopped Beating. I went to school as usual on the morning of the 8th of July 1994. Just before lunchtime, our lesson was interrupted when a teacher entered and told us that the school was closing for the day. We were all instructed to return home and turn on the television. This was odd, since there was no daytime television during weekdays. Instead of going home, I went with a girlfriend to her apartment near the school. We turned on the television. Shortly after, the famous news anchor Ri Chun-hee came on, dressed in black. Her eyes were red from crying. She then announced the impossible. Kim Il-sung, the great leader, the father of our nation, was dead. The announcement made on the radio was equally dramatic.
The great heart has stopped beating.
My friend broke into a wail and couldn't stop. Her crying affected me a little, but it was my mind that was moved, not my heart. How could he die? Incredible as it may sound now, it had never occurred to me, or to many North Koreans, that this God King, so powerful that he could control the weather, might die. He was flawless and almighty. He existed so far above humankind that a part of me didn't think he was real. We did not even think he needed to sleep or urinate. But he died. A door opened in my mind. Here's an 82-year-old man, I thought. He grew old and weak. He was human after all. I sat there listening to my friend's sobs, but my eyes were dry. I was too raw with grief for my father to spend my tears on the great leader. The next morning, the entire school gathered in front of the school building. We stood in long, regimented lines. The sky was a milky blue, and the day was warming up uncomfortably. Emotional speeches were made by the headmaster and the teachers, all of whom were choking with tears, to a background accompaniment of piped funeral music. Hour after hour it went on. I had felt sad at first, but after 3 hours of standing under the hot sun, I was becoming thirsty and tired. Nobody had ordered us to cry. No one had hinted that if we didn't cry, we would fall under suspicion. But we knew our tears were being demanded. From all around me came the sounds of sniffing, sobbing, and wailing. It looked as if everyone was beside themselves with grief. My survival instinct kicked in. If I didn't cry like everyone else, I'd be in trouble. So I rubbed my face in false distress, surreptitiously spat on my fingertips, and dabbed my eyes. I made a gasping noise that I hoped sounded like I was heaving with despair. After a long time doing this, I felt I could not stand there for much longer. The sun was now overhead. It was very warm, so I stumbled a little. The teachers thought I was about to faint, so they put me in the ambulance that was there on standby. That was a relief. The next day, there was a similar event joined by all the city's schools at the victorious Battle of Pochombo Memorial in Haesan Park. This time, several thousand students and teachers joined in the sobbing and the wailing. The grief seemed to be getting more extreme by the hour. A kind of hysteria was spreading across the city. Our schooling stopped. The steel and lumber mills, the factories, shops and markets closed. Every citizen had to participate in daily mass events to demonstrate their inconsolable sorrow. Day after day, a teacher took us into the hills to pick wild flowers to place before the bronze statue of Kim Il-sung in Haesan Park. After a few days, every flower had been picked, but we had to find them from somewhere. To turn up with one flower was an insult to the great leader. On one of these searches for flowers, a swarm of dragonflies flew alongside us in the field.
Look, in a voice full of wonder, the teacher said. Even the dragonflies are sad at the great leader's death.
She was being serious, and we took the comment uncritically. After the mourning period, as I'd feared might happen, punishment awaited those who had shed too few tears. On the day classes resumed, the entire student body gathered in front of the school to hurl criticism and abuse at a girl accused of faking her tears. The girl was terrified, and this time really crying. I felt sorry for her, but my main emotion was relief.
As a fake choir myself, I was just glad no one had seen through my performance. Many adults across the city were similarly accused, and the Puibu made a spate of arrests. It wasn't long before notices began appearing, giving the time and place for clusters of public executions. It is mandatory from elementary school to attend public executions. Often classes would be cancelled so students could go. Factories would send their workers to ensure a large crowd. I always tried to avoid attending, but on one occasion that summer I made an exception because I knew one of the men being killed. Many people in Haesan knew him. You might think the execution of an acquaintance is the last thing you'd want to see. In fact, people made excuses not to go if they didn't know the victim. But if they knew the victim, they felt obliged to go, as they would to a funeral. He was in his 20s and always seemed to have money. He was popular with the girls and had followers among the city's hoodlums. His crime was helping people to escape to China and selling banned goods. But his real offence was to continue his illegal activity during the mourning period following Kim Il-sung's death. He was to be shot along with three others at Haesan Airport, a common site for executions. The three men were brought out of a van before a large crowd, waiting in the glaring heat. Immediately, people around me began to whisper. The popular guy had to be lifted up and dragged to the post by a group of police, with the tips of his feet scraping along in the dust. He seemed half dead already. Each of the three had his head, chest, and waist tied to a stake. His hands and feet were tied together behind the stake. A perfunctory people's trial opened, in which the judge announced that the criminals had confessed their crimes. He asked if they had any last words. He wasn't expecting a response, since all three had been gagged and had stones pushed into their mouths to stop them cursing the regime with their final breath. Three uniformed marksmen then lined up, opposite each of them, and took aim. The marksmen's faces were flushed, I noticed. Executioners were known to drink alcohol beforehand. The noise of the reports ricocheted in the dry air. Three shots. First in the head, the second in the chest, and the third in the stomach. When the shot hit the popular guy's head, it exploded, leaving a fine pink mist. His family had been forced to watch from the front row. Chapter 15. Girlfriend of a Hoodlum. When I turned 15, I began attending a special class for girls only, where we learned to knit and keep house. We should have been learning about sex. All of us were astonishingly ignorant about men and about the most basic facts of reproduction. For all its interference in our lives, the party was extraordinarily bashful when it came to telling us how life itself was made. This was despite the fact that a teenage pregnancy could land a girl in a terrible situation. She'd have to marry immediately to avoid trouble. An abortion would have been difficult to arrange and probably would not even have been suggested. Instead, she'd have been forced to give the baby up for adoption or to a state orphanage. I believed that I could get pregnant if I kissed a man or held hands with him. My girlfriends thought the same. The boys' ignorance of sex was just as bad. I once saw a group of youths in their early teens near the pharmacy opposite Haesan Station, blowing up condoms as if they were balloons and kicking them about in the street. If someone had told them what those items were for, they would have run away red-faced. With such an utter lack of sexual awareness, none of us blossoming girls showed off our maturing bodies, or flirted, or teased boys at school. The North Korean brassiere is shaped like a blouse designed to flatten rather than enhance our breasts. One of the girls in my class had large breasts. Instead of being envied by the girls, she was teased. I finally learned about the sexual act from an unexpected source. A girlfriend from school invited me home one afternoon to watch an illegal South Korean drama on video. We turned on the recorder. However, we found that one of the adults of the house had left another type of video inside. It took me a minute to figure out what I was seeing. The screen filled with a jumble of limbs and intimate body parts, accompanied by rhythmic grunting and moaning. My friends started chuckling at my shocked face. I had never even seen anyone kiss in a North Korean movie. Pornography, in party propaganda,
was a pernicious foreign corruption. But this love-making video, as she called it, had been made in Pyongyang, for sale abroad and for circulation among elite party cadres. I would not have believed it if the actors hadn't spoken in such familiar accents. I lost my innocence that day. To my mind, my country did too. Like my other friends, when I menstruated for the first time, I went through three emotions in sharp succession. Shock, embarrassment, and absolute panic. I had to use my wits to figure out what to do. Incredibly, most of us handled it, without telling anyone or asking our mothers for advice. My mother, the most sensible woman I knew, offered me none, just as my grandmother, I'm sure, had given her none. It was at the height of my panic during my first menstrual cycle that one of the girls in class told me she'd seen something that had scared her at a public toilet near our school. She wanted to show me. We crept in there to take a look together. The place was dripping, dim, and stinking. Next to the hole of the squat toilet was a bloodied white plastic bag. Inside was a dead baby with a tiny blue-pink face. The mother must have given birth there and fled. The umbilical cord and the placenta lay next to it. I was shocked to the core and didn't sleep that night. That year, 1995, I dated my first boyfriend. He was 4 years older than me, and a hoodlum. His name was Taechul. He was tall, thin, and wore a Japanese casual jacket, the height of sophistication in Haesan. He had a conceited little half-smile I found attractive. Every North Korean city has hoodlums. They are not violent criminals, but young people with the kind of personality that attracts followers and who often deal in banned goods. There's quite a lot of low-level crime they can get away with, as long as they do nothing that verges on the political and attracts the eyes of the puibu. He had money. He was also in the police academy and was training to be a policeman. Just walking with him thrilled me because of the attention I was getting. In fact, after he waited for me a few times outside the school gate, the rumours started flying about us. This was quite a serious matter, because when the word gets out that a girl has been dating, it's not easy for her to find another match. I worried about this, but I liked him. I was proud that he wanted to go out with me when so many other girls wanted him. We would go to his house to listen to South Korean pop cassettes and play guitar and accordion together. Like any other boyfriend and girlfriend in North Korea of this age, we did not even kiss. Holding hands was as far as it went. Even then we were discreet. Our families were not aware of our romance and did not consider it improper for me to be at his house. My mother would have had a stroke if she'd known he was my boyfriend. That year, I found my duties with the Socialist Youth League more oppressive than ever. In spring, we had to help plant rice saplings. In the summer, we weeded and spread fertilizer. And in autumn came the harvest, which students and workers from all over the country helped with. This mass enterprise, in fields of flying red banners, was the epitome of communist idealism. In the summer, we were also ordered to dig tunnels around our school. The entire country was being mobilized, and everyone was on a war footing. Sirens wailed almost daily, and everybody dropped what they were doing and dashed to and fro in frenzy, practicing air raid drills in case of an attack. America and South Korea were about to launch a nuclear strike, we were told. War could break out at any minute. The thought of nuclear war terrified me. My mother panicked and gave a lot of stuff away. She gave all our spare blankets and pillows to Uncle Paw and his family on the collective farm. The boys dug frantically with shovels, and the girls shifted the earth. I hated every minute of this. If war started while we were at school, several hundred students were supposed to hide in the warren of tunnels. I was worried that our amateur engineering might prove disastrous and bury us alive. I was skeptical, too, of whether these tunnels were deep enough to protect us from a nuclear strike. Years later, I discovered that the propaganda had an element of truth. The United States had actually been considering airstrikes against our country's nuclear plants. After one of these tedious and exhausting days of digging and air raid drills, I went to my friend Sunny's house after school. She was in the tight bunch of friends I hung out with, but this was the first time I'd been to her home. Usually she came to mine. "Shall we eat something?" I said. "I'm hungry."
"I'm not sure what we've got."
She sounded vague. "Anything."
"We don't have much."
This annoyed me. "You're always getting snacks at my house." "I don't need a meal," I said. Sunny hesitated. She was embarrassed.
"Come here," she said, leading me into the kitchen.
Four pots sat on the stove. She slid the lid off one.
"Look, I can't give you this."
Inside the pot were thick, dark green objects. She put the lid back on before I could ask what they were, but I could tell it wasn't normal food. On the way home, I realized they might have been corn stalks. Why would her mother be cooking such a thing instead of rice? Chapter 16. By the time you read this, the five of us will no longer exist in this world. My mother came home from work looking tired and distracted. She hadn't been sleeping much since my father had died, and had more lines beneath her eyes and around her mouth. It had been months since I'd seen her smile. But at least she was able to provide for us through her small business deals. We had food and money. Her job at the local government bureau also meant that she had access to farm produce managed by her office. This gave her an opportunity for graft that she was expected to exercise. Soon after Kim Il-sung's death, the government had stopped paying salaries. It continued to give out ration coupons through the workplace, but these were becoming increasingly worthless. For some reason, there were fewer and fewer goods to exchange for them. She brought home a letter received by one of her colleagues. It was from the woman's sister, who lived in North Hamgyong province, a neighbouring province to the east of ours. My mother wanted to show it to us. "I need you and Minho to know something. People are having a hard time. You ask me for this and complain we don't have that. Not everyone has what we have." She handed me the letter.
"Dear sister, by the time you read this, the five of us will no longer exist in this world. We have not eaten for a few weeks. We are emaciated, though recently our bodies have become bloated. We are waiting to die. My one hope before I go is to eat some corn cake."
My first response was puzzlement. Why hadn't they eaten for weeks? This was one of the most prosperous countries in the world. Every evening the news showed factories and farms producing in abundance, well-fed people enjoying leisure time, and the department stores in Pyongyang filled with goods. And why was this woman's last wish to eat corn cake? Poor man's cake. Shouldn't she want to see her sister one last time? The realization was slow in coming. I thought of how offhand I'd been with my friend Sunny, because she hadn't offered me a snack at her house. I was mortified. Her family was struggling to find food. A few days later, I witnessed famine for the first time. I was at the market outside Wuyan Station, in Haesan, and saw a woman lying on her side on the ground with a baby in her arms. She was young, in her 20s. The baby, a boy, was about 2 years old, and staring at his mother. They were pale and skeletal, and dressed in rags. The woman's face was caked with filth, and her hair badly matted. She looked sick. To my astonishment,